Chapter 12. Hammock and Honey. 80 years later, he could still recall with the young pang of the original joy his falling in love with Ada. Memory met imagination halfway in the hammock of his boyhood's dawns. At 94, he liked retracing that first amorous summer, not as a dream he had just had, but as a recapitulation of consciousness to sustain him in the small gray hours between shallow sleep and the first pill of the day. Take over, dear, for a little while. Pill, pillow, billow, billions. Go on from here, Ada, please. She. Billions of boys. Take one fairly decent decade. A billion of bills, good, gifted, tender and passionate, not only spiritually but physically well-meaning billions, have bared the jillions of their no less tender and brilliant jills during that decade, at stations and under conditions that have to be controlled and specified by the worker, lest the entire report be choked up by the weeds of statistics and waist-high generalizations. No point would there be if we left out, for example, the little matter of prodigious individual awareness and young genius, which makes, in some cases, of this or that particular gasp an unprecedented and unrepeatable event in the continuum of life, or at least a thematic anthemia of such events in a work of art or a denouncer's article. The details that shine through or shade through, the local leaf through the hyaline skin, the green sun in the brown humid eye, tout ceci vicio et tout, in tit and toto, must be taken into account. Now prepare to take over. No, Ada. Go on. Ya zaslushalsya. I'm all enchantment and ears. If we wish to convey the fact, the fact, the fact, that among those billions of brilliant couples, in one cross-section of what you will allow me to call space-time, for the convenience of reasoning, one couple is a unique, super-imperial couple, Sverhimperatorskaya Cheta, in consequence of which, to be inquired into, to be painted, to be denounced, to be put to music, or to the question and death, if the decade has a scorpion tail after all, the peculiarities of their lovemaking influence in a special, unique way two long lives and a few readers, those pensive reeds in their pens and mental paintbrushes, natural history indeed, unnatural history, because that precision of senses and sense must seem unpleasantly peculiar to peasants, and because the detail is all. The song of a Tuscan firecrest, or a Sitka kinglet in a cemetery cypress, the minty whiff of summer savory or yerba buena on a coastal slope.
This is the end of disc number 2. Please insert disc number 3. This is disc number 3.
Natural history, indeed. Unnatural history. Because that precision of senses and sense must seem unpleasantly peculiar to peasants, and because the detail is all. The song of a Tuscan firecrest, or a Sitka kinglet in a cemetery cypress, the minty whiff of summer savory or yerba buena on a coastal slope, the dancing flitter of a holly blue or an echo azure, combined with other birds, flowers, and butterflies, that has to be heard, smelled, and seen through the transparency of death and ardent beauty. And the most difficult, beauty itself as perceived through the there and then, the males of the firefly. Now it's really your turn, Van. The males of the firefly, a small luminous beetle more like a wandering star than a winged insect, appeared on the first warm black nights of Ardis, one by one, here and there. Then, in a ghostly multitude, dwindling again to a few individuals as their quest came to its natural end. Van watched them with the same pleasurable awe he had experienced as a child, when, lost in the purple crepuscule of an Italian hotel garden, in an alley of cypresses. He supposed they were golden ghouls or the passing fancies of the garden. Now, as they softly flew, apparently straight, crossing and recrossing the darkness around him, each flashed his pale lemon light every 5 seconds or so, signaling in his own specific rhythm, quite different from that of an allied species, flying with Photinus ladarensis, according to Ada, at Lugano and Luga, to his grass-domiciled female, pulsating in photic response after taking a couple of moments to verify the exact type of light code he used. The presence of those magnificent little animals, delicately illuminating as they passed the fragrant night, filled Vaughn with a subtle exhilaration that Ada's entomology seldom evoked in him, maybe in result of the abstract scholar's envy which a naturalist's immediate knowledge sometimes provokes. The hammock, a comfortable oblong nest, reticulated his naked body either under the weeping cedar that sprawled over one corner of a lawn and granted a partial shelter in case of a shower, or, on safer nights, between two tulip trees, where a former summer guest, with an opera cloak over his clammy nightshirt, had awoken once because a stink bomb had burst among the instruments in the horse cart, and striking a match, Uncle Vaughn had seen the bright blood blotching his pillow. The windows in the black castle went out in rows, files, and night moves. The longest occupant of the nursery water closet was Mademoiselle La Riviere, who came there with a rose oil lamp pad and her bouvard. A breeze ruffled the hangings of his now infinite chamber. Venus rose in the sky. Venus set in his flesh. All that was a little before the seasonal invasion of a certain interestingly primitive mosquito, whose virulence the not too kind Russian contingent of our region attributed to the diet of the French wine growers and bogberry eaters of Lador. But even so, the fascinating fireflies and the still more eerie pale cosmos coming through the dark foliage balanced with new discomforts the nocturnal ordeal, the harassments of sweat and sperm associated with his stuffy room. Night, of course, always remained an ordeal throughout the near century of his life, no matter how drowsy or drugged the poor man might be. For genius is not all gingerbread, even for billionaire Bill with his pointed beardlet and stylized bald dome, or crusty Proust, who liked to decapitate rats when he did not feel like sleeping. Or this, brilliant or obscure VV, depending on the eyesight of the readers, also poor people, despite our jibes and their jobs. But at Ardis, the intense life of the star-haunted sky troubled the boy's night so much that, on the whole, he felt grateful when foul weather or the fouler gnat, the Kamargsky Kumar of our Mujiks and the Mustik Moscovite of their no less alliterative retaliators, drove him back to his bumpy bed. In this, our dry report on Van Veen's early, too early love for Ada Veen, there is neither reason nor room for metaphysical digression. Yet, let it be observed, just while the lucifers fly and throb and an owl hoots, also most rhythmically, in the nearby park, that Van, who at the time had still not really tasted the terror of Terra, vaguely attributing it, when analyzing his dear, unforgettable Aqua's torments, to pernicious fads and popular fantasies, even then, at 14, recognized that the old myths, which willed into helpful being a whirl of worlds, no matter how silly and mystical, and situated them within the gray matter of the star-suffused heavens, contained, perhaps, a glowworm of strange truth. His nights in the hammock, where that other poor youth had cursed his blood cough and sunk back into dreams of prowling black spumas and a crash of cymbals in an orchal orchestra, as suggested to him by career physicians, were now haunted not so much by the agony of his desire for Ada as by that meaningless space overhead, underhead, everywhere, the demon counterpart of divine time, tingling about him and through him, as it was to retingle with a little more meaning, fortunately, in the last nights of a life which I do not regret, my love. He would fall asleep at the moment he thought he would never sleep again, and his dreams were young. As the first flame of day reached his hammock, he woke up another man, and very much of a man indeed. Ada, our ardors and arbors, a dactylic trimeter that was to remain Van Veen's only contribution to Anglo-American poetry, sang through his brain. Bless the starling, and damn the stardust. He was 14 and a half. He was burning and bold. He would have her fiercely, someday. One such green resurrection he could particularize when replaying the past. Having drawn on his swimming trunks, having worked in and crammed in all that intricate, reluctant, multiple machinery, he had toppled out of his nest and forthwith endeavored to determine whether her part of the house had come alive. It had. He saw a flash of crystal, a fleck of color. She was having sa petite collation du matin, alone on a private balcony. Van found his sandals, with a beetle in one and a petal in the other, and through the tool room entered the cool house. Children of her type contrived the purest philosophies. Ada had worked out her own little system. Hardly a week had elapsed since Van's arrival when he was found worthy of being initiated in her web of wisdom. An individual's life consisted of certain classified things, real things, which were unfrequent and priceless, simply things which formed the routine stuff of life, and ghost things, also called fogs, such as fever, toothache, dreadful disappointments, and death. Three or more things occurring at the same time formed a tower, or if they came in immediate succession, they made a bridge. Real towers and real bridges were the joys of life. And when the towers came in a series, one experienced supreme rapture. It almost never happened, though. In some circumstances, in a certain light, a neutral thing might look or even actually become real, or else, conversely, it might coagulate into a fetid fog. When the joy and the joyless happened to be intermixed, simultaneously or along the ramp of duration, one was confronted with ruined towers and broken bridges. The pictorial and architectural details of her metaphysics made her nights easier than Van's, and that morning, as on most mornings, he had the sensation of returning from a much more remote and grim country than she and her sunlight had come from. Her plump, stickily glistening lips smiled. "When I kiss you here," he said to her years later, "I always remember that blue morning on the balcony, when you were eating a tartine au miel, so much better in French." The classical beauty of clover honey, smooth, pale, translucent, freely flowing from the spoon and soaking my love's bread and butter in liquid brass, the crumb steeped in nectar. "Real thing?" he asked. "Tower," she answered. And the wasp. The wasp was investigating her plate. Its body was throbbing. "We shall try to eat one later," she observed, "but it must be gorged to taste good. Of course, it can't sting your tongue. No animal will touch a person's tongue. When a lion has finished a traveler, bones and all, he always leaves the man's tongue lying like that in the desert," making a negligent gesture. "I doubt it. It's a well-known mystery." Her hair was well brushed that day and sheened darkly in contrast with the lusterless pallor of her neck and arms. She wore the striped T-shirt which in his lone fantasies he especially liked to peel off her twisting torso. The oilcloth was divided into blue and white squares. A smear of honey stained what remained of the butter in its cool crock. "All right. And the third real thing?" she considered him. A fiery droplet in the wick of her mouth considered him. A three-colored velvet violet, of which she had done an aquarelle on the eve, considered him from its fluted crystal. She said nothing. She licked her spread fingers, still looking at him. Van, getting no answer, left the balcony. Softly her tower crumbled in the sweet, silent sun.